We're going to begin to read at verse 28 of John chapter 18, and I'm going to read through to verse 16 of chapter 19. Now, this, as you will quickly gather, is an account of Jesus' trial. Let's hear God's word then. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews did not enter the palace. They wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," the Jews objected. This happened so that the words Jesus had spoken, indicating the kind of death he was going to die, would be fulfilled. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" "Do you think I'm a Jew?" Pilate replied. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate asked. With this he went out again to the Jews and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him, but it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in a rebellion. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, O King of the Jews!" And they struck him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to him, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify! Crucify!" But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jews insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king or opposes Caesar..." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of Passover week, about the sixth hour. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. John and Bill were glued to the television screen. It was match of the day. And the two teams which John and Bill supported with almost religious devotion happened to be playing each other, Manchester United and Arsenal. It was an end of the season match, and there were only a few minutes of time left, and the score was still nil all. Suddenly, the Manchester United star, Dave Beckham, soon to be Mr. Posh Spice, surged up the right wing and played a beautiful cross into the Arsenal goal mouth, where Andy Cole volleyed the ball past goalkeeper Seaman into the back of the net. The mounting hum of the Manchester supporters erupted into a roar. John leapt from the couch and began to cavort around the room, waving his arms like a Red Indian invoking rain. John was, needless to say, the Manchester United fan. But as he looked once more at the screen, his wild dance froze in midair, and the ecstatic grin was wiped from his face by a blank stare of disbelief. "The linesman had his flag up for offside," observed the BBC commentator dispassionately. "Beckham is protesting, but the referee is shaking his head. The goal is disallowed." John groaned with disappointment, and then began to thrust an accusing finger at the screen. "What's the matter with that referee's eyes?" he demanded. "Anyone could see that pass was okay?"
It looked offside to me," volunteered Bill, looking considerably relieved.
"Well, you would say that, wouldn't you?" retorted John, "you having been practically born and brought up at Highbury. I'm telling you, he was robbed. That was a goal, fair and square." Bill shrugged his shoulders. "The ref didn't think so," he replied, with just a trace of smugness in his voice. "And that's what counts, you know." "Rubbish," insisted John indignantly. "What counts is the truth. And the truth is, that was a goal." Well, was it? Or wasn't it? You'll say, "How can I judge, Roy? I wasn't there." Which is fair enough. But suppose you had been there, would you have been in any better position to determine whether John or Bill were right about that pass? I've no doubt Desmond Lynham and Gary Lineker went on to debate the issue at length on that edition of Match of the Day. Later, with the aid of slow-motion replays, multiple camera angles, and expert interpretation of the offside law as currently defined in the rulebook of association football. But do even they have any right to say whether it was a goal or not? John, you remember, insisted that what counted was the truth. But when it comes to disputed goals in a football match, where does truth lie? It's quite an interesting question, isn't it? And it has far-reaching philosophical implications in our late 20th century, you know. Because, to quote the title of a recent book, "Truth is stranger than it used to be." We used to think, like John, you see, that there was an objective, absolute truth out there which was accessible to an impartial and rational mind. It was the essence of the scientific method to determine that truth. And once it was established, it couldn't be questioned by any sensible person. It was an indisputable scientific fact, as we would say. But our confidence in that kind of rationalistic certainty is rapidly evaporating at the end of our century. The arena of scientifically established facts is shrinking. We no longer really have a public domain of objective truth to which everybody can appeal. All we have these days are TV presenters' analyses, the prejudices of the man in the street, and the referee's decision. Truth is no longer a fact. It is an opinion. At least that's how a lot of people see it. I mean, take the person I had an argument with yesterday. She was a highly articulate and intelligent young lady, but she had taken exception to a remark I made in my sermon at the wedding which took place here yesterday afternoon. We had been talking about 5 minutes, I suppose, and we were not getting very far. At length, she came out with the sentence I had been dreading. I must have heard it at least 100 times in the last year or two. "What you're saying may be true for you," she said, "but it isn't true for me." Such a sentiment, so common these days, is almost platitudinous. It's the way arguments always seem to end up, isn't it? You're not allowed these days to say to the other person, "I think you're wrong." That's rude and intolerant. To be politically correct, you have to affirm their right to hold their opinion on the matter, but insist that you have an equal right to differ. It's a bit like John saying to Bill, "Well, that pass may be offside as far as you're concerned, but it was a goal in my judgment." The referee may have the official authority to determine the score that goes in the record book, but he can't determine the truth. No one can. The truth is inaccessible. lost in a confusion of equally valid but mutually contradictory opinions. This sort of attitude is given a label these days. It's called postmodernism, and some of us are sick of it, aren't we? But it's the distinctive feature of postmodernism that it rejects all authoritarian claims to absolute and objective truth. Postmodernism puts us all in a kind of philosophical equivalent of Legoland. We can all gather whatever pieces we like and construct a kind of Disney world to our own design, a version of reality in which we want to play, our own construction of truth. And of course, if life were just a game, or if it were just goals in a football match that were in dispute, maybe it wouldn't matter too much. But you see, that the trouble is, I was talking to that particular young lady yesterday about Jesus. She didn't like it, and I don't blame her. Jesus is a profoundly disturbing person, especially if you share this postmodern perspective, which she clearly did. Did you notice the outrageous claim Jesus made in our reading in that very respect, in 18 verse 37? For this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. Can you believe that? Talk about politically incorrect. Jesus insists here he has something far stronger than mere personal opinion to offer. He offers truth, and by that word he clearly means something absolute and objective, which all right-thinking people must acknowledge to be true. It's because he offers truth of that order that he claims the right to master us, of course, to be our king, to use his word here, to control our decisions, our plans, our very lives. Which of us welcomes such an intrusive sovereign authority? I can well understand why that young lady yesterday jibbed at the idea. But you see, instead of saying simply, "No, Roy, I reject your Jesus' claims," this young lady, in typical 1990s fashion, wanted to cast our debate in the form simply of a legitimate difference of opinion. "It may be right for Jesus to be your Lord," she said, "but that doesn't mean he has to be my Lord." "But what if this claim of his to be the Son of God is true?" I protested. And that's when she came out with the dreaded sentence. I knew it was coming. "That may be true for you," she said, "but it isn't true for me." Now, as I say, she's far from alone in arguing that point of view, and she can't be blamed for it in any way, because book after book is being written defending this subjectivist perspective. And nowhere more, though, of course, in the field of theology. I remember a year or so ago I read a book by Professor Keith Ward, who holds the Chair of Divinity at Oxford. It's called A Vision to Pursue. And in that book, Professor Ward tells us why he no longer believes in an orthodox Christian doctrine of the Incarnation. That is, that Jesus was both God and man, united in a single person. That whole idea, he says on page 18 of his book, is founded on a mistake. What we have in the New Testament, he says, is not an objective witness to the real Jesus of history, but an expression of the subjective religious experience of the early Christians, rendered in narrative form. The purpose of the Gospels, then, is not to tell us what really happened, still less to tell us who Jesus really was. The purpose of the Gospels, he says, is to evoke religious sentiment in us. So, according to Professor Ward, Jesus is a bit like that Manchester United goal. We all have our different responses to him. Some of us may like to claim we are more expertly informed on the question, like Desmond Lynam. Some may claim more ecclesiastical authority to determine the matter, like the referee. Some may be more obviously influenced by personal prejudice, like John or Bill. But at the end of the day, objective truth is simply not available to any of us. Whether you're talking about football or Jesus, subjective opinions is all there is. Because the trouble with this new postmodern point of view is that there's so much about it that is self-evidently right. I mean, nobody in their right mind would be so arrogant as to suggest that they had infallible access to absolute truth. And the question is, does that admission commit us to a kind of slippery slope from which there is no exit until we all slide through the trap door of total skepticism? Does it mean we have no access at all to objective truth? I mean,
maybe I'm very naive on this. But surely that pass, you know, the one of Dave Beckham's to Andy Cole, surely that either was offside or it wasn't. No? It wasn't relatively offside. It wasn't subjectively offside. It either was or it wasn't offside. Isn't that right? And therefore the goal was either rightly or wrongly disallowed. We can argue about that. But the truth is out there. Even if Bill and John argue about it till kingdom come, their argument is about a reality, not some illusion in their minds. And by the same token, Jesus either was the Son of God or he wasn't. And that young lady was therefore either justified in her dismissal of his claims over her life, or she was gambling with her eternal destiny. Truth may be stranger than it used to be these days, but it's surely going too far to suggest we don't really believe that objective truth exists anymore. Only the wild and wacky, surely, would go that far. I mean, if we really believed that, how would we ever try anybody in a court of law, for instance? The whole business of justice depends upon you having witnesses who know the difference between true testimony and perjury. You can't get very far if the witnesses don't understand that simple distinction. The whole business of justice is about the court coming to a verdict beyond reasonable doubt. If truth is inaccessible, as people like Professor Ward and that young lady seem to be suggesting, then that sort of even qualified certainty will always elude us. Reason can never escape from doubt. And that means that every human judicial decision is fundamentally unsafe. If we don't believe we can distinguish whether a goal is offside or not, how can we possibly distinguish whether somebody is guilty or not? Perhaps that's what makes this part of the gospel story in John especially interesting, because of course John 18 and 19 are set in a court. Jesus is on trial. First before the law of the Jews in the earlier part of chapter 18, represented by Caiaphas, the high priest. And then before the law of Rome, represented by Pontius Pilate in that section we read. Before each of these courts, Jesus protests his innocence and insists he has done nothing but witness to the truth. But the tragic outcome is that instead of being vindicated, these two courts sentence him to death. Well, is there anything wrong about that? This is the irony John wants us to reflect upon, you see. The irony of a world which conspires in the crucifixion of the truth. How does it happen? Why does it happen? I want to suggest to you this morning, quite briefly, I hope, that John gives us two vital insights into that question, which are of great relevance to our elusive quest for truth at the end of the 20th century. These are the two insights he gives us. First, he says, the truth is crucified by the prejudice of minds that are too sure they already have the truth. Truth is crucified by the prejudice of minds that are too sure they already have the truth. And secondly, truth is crucified by the cynicism of a mind that no longer believes it can find the truth. Truth is crucified by a cynicism of a mind that no longer believes it can find the truth. Those, if you like, are the twin poles with which men and women at the end of the 20th century have to struggle in their quest for truth. Let's look first at the prejudice of minds that are too sure they have the truth. And here I just want you to look back a fraction before our reading to chapter 18, verses 19 to 23. Notice how Jesus speaks this time to the Jewish court, the high priest. In verse 19, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is that any way to answer the high priest? He demanded. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what was wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?
I guess we could have hoped that of all people, the religious leaders of Judea might have recognized the moral and the spiritual pedigree of Jesus. But sadly, all the Gospels tell us that it was really the Jewish hierarchy, the visible church of the Jewish community, that more than any other body was responsible for his death. It was they who got him arrested. It was Annas and Caiaphas, the ancient equivalent of the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of York, who personally pressed charges against him. It was, of course, a kangaroo court. They knew, as Jesus did, that these judicial proceedings were highly irregular. According to Jewish law, you could not conduct a case of this sort in the hours of darkness, nor could you convict a person without the evidence of independent witnesses. Without corroborative evidence, even a confession of guilt was not sufficient to condemn a man. That's why, you see, Jesus demands here that they bring in the witnesses. He knew he could not be convicted legally without witnesses. But their response to this perfectly proper and indeed legal demand is to stoop to the bullying interrogation techniques of a Gestapo officer. They slap him around the face. Jesus, by comparison, remains conspicuously self-restrained and dignified, I think. "I'm only asking for a fair trial," he insists. "Is there a crime in that?" Now, we know from the other three Gospels that much more transpired in this hearing before the Jewish authorities than John records. False witnesses are eventually wheeled in, and the entire Jewish council meets, and Jesus is eventually put on a solemn oath and forced to reply to a direct challenge, "Are you the Son of God?" Whereupon he replies in the affirmative. "I am," he says, "and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the Almighty and coming in the clouds of heaven." Whereupon they convicted him of blasphemy and sentenced him to death. All of that detail John has left out, I think, probably because he knows that all that information was already available to his readers through Gospels like Mark and Luke, which were already in their hands. Nevertheless, it is essentially the same picture he describes here. A malicious prosecution without a shred of proper legal process conducted by the highest authorities in the Jewish community. It's quite clear they had made up their minds long before what was to happen to Jesus. This was not a trial. This was a judicial process to legitimize the outcome they had already decided upon. Notice what they say to Pilate in 19 verse 7. "We have a law, and according to that law he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." Ironic that, of course, because the law they're referring to is the law of Moses, the law of the Bible, the law of God. How inadequate that law now seems, wielded as it is by a prejudiced jury. But that is how it often will be when people are convinced they already hold unchallenged knowledge of the truth. Blinkered religious orthodoxy will find no space for an unbiased consideration of a man like Jesus. He claims to be the Son of God. That's heresy by definition. That's blasphemy. The law says so. Death for such a crime. No tinge of self-doubt can be allowed to interfere with their certainty on this point, you see. I fear you will always find that kind of narrow-mindedness wherever you find people who are sure they hold the truth. It's always dangerous. Always dangerous. The very word truth itself can become distorted in such hands into a weapon of oppression, even as the law of Moses becomes distorted into a weapon of oppression here in the hands of Caiaphas. There was a time, of course, when the Christian religion operated in just such an oppressive fashion in Europe. One thinks of the Spanish Inquisition, the Star Chamber, things like that. One thinks of brave Galileo, persecuted because he had the effrontery to suggest that the earth moved around the sun, when the ecclesiastical referees of that particular football game in medieval Catholicism had already decided to disallow the goal. Would that those of us who are in the Protestant tradition could claim we had displayed a more commendable model of open-mindedness. But when you look into your history books, you will find, unfortunately, the reformers, even such a great reformer as Calvin, conducted their share of persecution and oppression too. And for precisely the same reason, you see. They were too sure they had the truth. Their articulation of theological correctness was absolutized, and anybody who contradicted it was by definition a heretic. That doesn't mean, of course, that conviction is wrong about theological things. But the only safe way to oppose an error, if an error you suspect is being made, is by refuting that error. Never, never by repressing that error. For refutation, you see, demands self-examination. When you try to refute somebody's point of view, you're forced to look into why you believe what you believe. Refutation is an exercise of intellectual engagement. Repression, on the other hand, is an act of power. It's a shortcut. And sometimes it crucifies the truth. It's to the shame of the church that it used its power in the 16th and 17th century to silence those who challenged its versions of the truth. And insofar as our contemporary postmodern philosophers seek to unmask that kind of ideological authoritarianism and denounce it, I think we have to applaud them. They're doing us a favour. The irony, of course, is that these days, the weapons of intellectual intimidation are being wielded not by the church any longer, for the church's authority long since waned, nor even by the scientists, the authority of whom is decidedly on the wane too. No, the people who are displaying the intolerance these days are the postmodernist philosophers. That's the big irony. In the subtle way they conduct their own conspiracy of academic terrorism to silence those who don't subscribe to their subjectivist viewpoint, their version of political correctness. Anyway, this is the first reason I suggest to you that truth gets crucified in our world, when people are too sure they have it. There's plenty of intellectual funnel vision still around, of course. That one has to ask whether it may not be here among us. Some of us, perhaps, who would call ourselves Christians, but who actually have more in common with Caiaphas the high priest than Jesus of Nazareth in our attitudes. Or perhaps some of us who are militant non-Christians here, who are convinced the Bible is nonsense, and nothing that preacher is going to say this morning, nothing I'm going to read in this Bible this morning, nothing that Jesus can say to me this morning is ever going to convince me otherwise. There's plenty of intellectual narrow-mindedness around, on both sides of the fence. Bang, bang, bang. That isn't nails, I hear, is it? Being hammered into a cross. The second reason the truth is crucified is this. The cynicism of a mind that no longer believes it can find the truth. And that takes us back to those words I mentioned earlier in chapter 18, verse 37. For this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. And notice Pilate's reply. What is truth? He asked. What do you think lies behind that cryptic, parting, rhetorical question? What is truth? Is this the dismissive contempt of a convinced skeptic? Is this a man like Caiaphas who's convinced this man Jesus is a dangerous fanatic? I don't think so. No, that what is truth suggests to me the wistfulness of a cynic. A man who perhaps in his youth dreamed of finding some truth to live by, but has long since given up that hope and is left now with nothing but questions, unanswered questions. It is quite clear that Pilate was convinced Jesus was innocent. He'd interrogated dozens of subversives, dozens of would-be revolutionaries, and he knew Jesus didn't fit into that category. This man had never wielded a sword in his life. Anyone could see that. Besides, if he'd really been a revolutionary, the last thing the Jews would have done would have been to deliver him to the Roman authorities. They'd have been making a hero of him. Pilate was wise enough to know that too. No, this man's crime had to be something to do with religion, not politics. And having established that, one might have hoped that Pilate would have insisted upon Jesus' release from custody. Three times, after all, he pronounces him not guilty. So why is it we read at the end of our reading in 19 verse 16, finally Pilate handed him over to be crucified? Why do we read that? When three times this man has pronounced him innocent. Well, I suggest to you it's all tied up with that cynical question. What is truth? It is, as we said at the very beginning, once the courts of law stop believing in the accessibility of truth, the very idea of justice loses its meaning. A world without truth is a world where right and wrong can no longer be distinguished. And that has to be a world in consequence where political pragmatism will always triumph, never moral principle. That latest quip to come from across the other side of the Atlantic. George Washington couldn't tell a lie. Richard Nixon couldn't tell the truth. Bill Clinton can't tell the difference. But Bill Clinton is a postmodern. Bill Clinton is a political pragmatist suprema. It's at this point, of course, that the essentially incoherent nature of postmodernity is exposed. I mean, there are few generations that have been more self-righteous than ours. We contend for justice here, there, and everywhere. In Northern Ireland, in the Middle East, in Yugoslavia, in the Third World, in Tibet. We hail the protesters of Tiananmen Square and elevate them to the status of martyr saints. But if there is no truth, you see, then what did those brave students in Tiananmen Square die for? In a world without truth, there are no causes worth dying for any longer. All that's left is the law of the jungle. All that's left is the survival of the fittest. All that's left is do others before they do you. Of course Pilate handed him over to be crucified. Pilate was a political pragmatist. He had given up believing in truth long ago. Truth, insofar as that world meant anything for him, was determined by sociological consensus and political expediency. The people wanted Jesus dead. They threatened to tell him he was not a friend of Caesar if he allowed this man to live. That was enough for Pilate. That's all that mattered. After all, truth is just opinion. The art of politics, then, is to align your opinion with the majority. If that means abortion on demand, let there be abortion on demand. If that means all paedophiles should be lynched, let's lynch them. And if that means Jesus Christ should be crucified, let's crucify him. Pilate almost hops back and forwards in this exchange here, like a comic, doesn't he? Do you notice? The way he goes from Jesus, back to the Jews, back to Jesus, back to the Jews. He's behaving like a negotiator seeking a political compromise, not a judge seeking to administer justice. This is Mr. Blair's danger, of course, isn't it? Not that he's popular, but that he wants so much to be popular. How much, I wonder, would he be prepared to concede to maintain that unassailable lead of his in the opinion poll? Pilate was willing to crucify the truth. Are you? Oh no, of course, you're not a politician, nor am I. Nor have we, I guess, ever condemned anybody to death. But that cynicism in Pilate's question, what is truth, that isn't so rare among us, is it? Like Pilate, we don't always wait for Jesus' answer to that question. Some of you may recall, it was a couple of years ago now, I mentioned that I'd had a letter from a guy who used to be a student here in the Christian Union. He wrote to me to say why he felt unable any longer to call himself an evangelical Christian. The reason he gave in his letter was that he found evangelical Christianity too, quote, self-assured, that was his word, too reluctant to accommodate other people's ideas, too narrow-minded, too dogmatic, too unfashionably certain in this postmodern world. That was his complaint. And I remember writing back and expressing some sympathy, because I too am sometimes dismayed by the lack of open-mindedness, by the judgmentalism, by the censoriousness I find in some evangelical churches. I do detect sometimes an excessively defensive, rigidly doctrinaire kind of attitude. Some of my colleagues in the ministry, you know, display a kind of obscurantism in the way they use the phrase, "the Bible says," which is quite irresponsible and very authoritarian. It's no wonder that a young student going out of Cambridge, having imbibed the postmodern atmosphere here, finds it culturally alien in many of our evangelical churches. However, a few months ago, I had another letter from that same guy, first one I've received since we had that exchange of correspondence, it must be 2 years ago. He was a little more honest with me this time. He told me what it really was had pushed him out of evangelicalism into the liberal church where he now worships. He's gay, and he wanted to live a gay lifestyle. And he found the evangelical church just wasn't a place where he could do that comfortably. It couldn't always be like that at the bottom line, do you think? I mean, not that we're all gay, but that all of our cynicism about truth is rooted somewhere down there, not in philosophy, but in ethics. I wonder about that. I wonder if the real objection our modern world or our postmodern world has to the idea of objective truth is that truth implies that right and wrong do mean something. It was long ago that Norman Anderson, a professor of law here in Cambridge, directed me to a book by Aldous Huxley that I subsequently read called Ends and Means. It's a very fascinating paragraph in that book. I'll read it to you. Aldous Huxley writes in that book, "I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning. And consequently, I assumed that it had none. And I was able, without any difficulty, to find satisfying reasons for this assumption." He goes on, "The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, as for many of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness we embraced was essentially an instrument of moral liberation. The liberation we desired was a liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. The supporters of this system claimed it embodied a meaning, a Christian meaning, in the world. There was one admirably simple method of confuting these people and at the same time justifying ourselves in our erotic revolt. We would deny the world had any meaning whatever." So you have to beware that some of this subjectivity is not just a delusion, an artifice. One of the uncomfortable things the Bible says is that Jesus was crucified because of the sinfulness of the human race. Not because our philosophy was wrong, not because we had epistemological problems with truth. The Bible says Jesus was crucified ultimately because of the sinfulness of the human race. But sin, of course, is a category that a truth-denying world can't make much sense of. Because sin speaks of a righteous God who holds this human individual that I am to account for the use that I make of the moral freedom he has given to me. Sin is about moral responsibility. And in a world without truth, there is nothing and no one to be responsible to. Only opinions. The Bible insists it was a failure in moral responsibility which lay at the root of what happened to Jesus. "We crucified the truth that day," says the Bible. Not because we didn't believe in truth. Deep down we all know the truth is out there. Like that offside, or was it? The truth is out there. Now, the reason we crucified the truth that day is because deep down we did not want that truth commanding us. That truth is sovereign, you see. You are right in saying I am a king. For this reason I was born and for this I came into the world to testify to the truth. And everyone who is on the side of truth, therefore, listens to me. It's because in our rebellion and our self-will, we resent the constraint of the truth Jesus represents on our lives that we crucify truth. Still he stands, you know. Still he stands among us here today, the risen Jesus, just as he stood before Pilate. Still he is on trial among us. Or are we, like Pilate, really on trial before him? Truth on a cross doesn't coerce anybody. Truth on a cross doesn't torture anybody. Truth on a cross doesn't oppress anybody. Truth on a cross offers itself to a world of men and women who are free to say yes or no. And no matter how postmodern we may be, before we leave here today, we shall have said either yes or no to him. Be sure.